This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Equal.
Welcome to Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson at WDET in Detroit, and I'm joined in studio today with my producer, Kerry Jr. II.
Good morning, Stephen.
Hey. So today we're going to talk about a part of town that I've been familiar with for a really long time. Yeah. I went to high school not far from there. You did too.
We went to high school not
right?
far from
Even
there.
Even though we're separated in years, we're not separated in roots. So this part of town around Livernois and 6 Mile and 7 Mile has really changed over the last decade, really.
Definitely.
And especially over the last 5 or 6 years, it's just a much more vital and vibrant place. And that's because of a lot of investment that has come in. And today we're going to talk about how that investment is changing that neighborhood, but changing that neighborhood in a different way than we're seeing investments change other parts of Detroit.
Absolutely. I think for one, you can notice just by going over there, the streetscapes that they've done, that the open and the widened sidewalks, the new businesses that are over there. I mean, we've been talking about that area for a while now. And so I'm really interested to get into a conversation about what all that investment has done and what the experience has been like for the residents in that neighborhood. So I think we got a good one on our hands.
Yeah. And it brushes up against these big questions that we have, I think, in Detroit about how we make change and how we make change that includes the people who are here as opposed to moving them aside. And I think this is a really great setting for that conversation because, again, what's happened over there is really different than what we see in some other places. So
we're going to
get to that G word, gentrification, talk about what it means and what it looks like here and how this might be different.
Yep, and we've got a returning guest on this episode too, Stephen.
We do already. Yeah. Andre Perry of the Brookings Institution is going to join us, as is Chase Cantrell, who is a resident of one of the neighborhoods, but also operates Building Community Value, which is a really interesting experiment, really, in the idea of inclusive, community-driven development. So we got to get to it here.
We got to get to it.
Yeah. So let me first welcome our guests. Andre Perry, welcome back to Created Equal. You are a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and you research race, structural inequality, and education.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. And Chase, in addition to being the founder and executive director of Building Community Value, you lecture at the University of Michigan Taubman College of Architecture and Urban Planning, and you're a former real estate and corporate attorney. Chase, you've been with me in the studio many times, but this is the first time on Created Equal.
That's right.
So it's great to have you here.
It is a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. So I want to start with what we're talking about, the area that we're talking about. Livernois, 6 Mile corridor, really 6 Mile all the way up to 8 Mile, I think is an appropriate way to describe where all of this change is taking place. Let's start with what's happening over there and what change is actually taking place. Chase, I'll start with you. You live there.
Sure. So I've lived in this neighborhood. So I live in the Bagley neighborhood of the 5 neighborhoods we're going to be talking about today. And, you know, I've lived there since 2017, also do a lot of work in the neighborhood. And as you said, there's a lot of investment happening. There's a lot of change that's happening. We're seeing, you know, streetscapes on 6 Mile, Livernois. So just the built environment looks very different. We have park investments. So Ella Fitzgerald Park in the Fitzgerald neighborhood, which, you know, I love to see. If you go there in the summertime, you have young Black Detroiters who are using that park. You know, the residents around that park are really adopting it. You know, lots of businesses are beginning to, you know, reopen and flourish. And being in the neighborhood itself, you see a lot of construction, just a lot of construction on the homes in that neighborhood. So a lot of investment also happening. So on the residential side, the streetscape, the parks and the businesses, there's lots of both private and, you know, public and philanthropic dollars that are going into that area.
And Livernois and 6 Mile are, of course, these sort of spines, I guess.
Exactly.
That commercial spines that define that area. They have real historic significance, in Detroit. They have real historic significance for African Americans in Detroit more recently. Talk about the role that those streets and what's happening there are playing in sort of the overall narrative about change in that area.
So whenever someone visits the city and they ask, all right, well, you know, I've been downtown or I've been around the greater downtown, where else should I visit in the city of Detroit? This just happened last week. And I'm like, well, you have to go to the Avenue of Fashion, right? You have to go to Livernois between 7 and 8 Mile. And you have to see all of the thriving black businesses that are over there and the history of it. I mean, it's always been a commercial corridor, a retail place. You know, you had the big shops, the Kresge's and the Hudson's downtown, but you had the more boutique shops on Livernois. And you still see some of that happening, right? Like you have very independent retailers who are on Livernois, providing anything from clothing. You know, we have Good Cakes and Bakes that everyone nationally loves to talk about.
Yes.
Had a Canadian journalist who visited Detroit a couple weeks ago, and he wanted to learn about Good Cakes and Bakes. So, I mean, that's what's happening on the Avenue. We're starting to see that sort of spread out a little bit also to 6 Mile. So Detroit Pizza Bar, you have Detroit Sip, and others along that strip. So, I love to learn the history. Jermon Jordan, the historian for the city of Detroit, mm-hmm. actually taught me a lot about the people who lived in these neighborhoods. You know, we're putting up a mural of Aaliyah on the side of one of our buildings, because Aaliyah actually lived
in Bagley.
In the University District.
Yeah.
So I didn't know that. So, you know, I'm learning all these
You're
things.
A little
about,
too young to remember that, I think.
Well, Aaliyah was my age, but I didn't. She's a little bit older, but around my age. But I didn't grow up in Bagley. I grew up off of 6 Mile,
yeah.
but closer to Greenfield. So, but I spent a lot of time at Mary Grove for summer programs or UDM for DAPSEP. So, you know, this was always just a place that people came to for lots of different reasons.
Yeah. So, Andre Perry, I want to bring you into the conversation here and talk about your research on this area. And I want to start with this number. There has been a 490% increase in investment over 10 years in the five neighborhoods that we're talking about around these two commercial corridors. Now, in most cases, in most cities, that kind of investment in that quick of a time would be accompanied by cultural and demographic changes that we would talk negatively about and be concerned about. In this case, that doesn't seem to be what's happening. So I want to start there with you talking about that investment, what it has meant and what it hasn't meant for that neighborhood.
Yeah, thanks for that question. I'll just give an overarching report out on this the report that we recently released, and it's called The Investment Without Displacement, How a Surge of Development Changed and Didn't Change One Detroit Neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
As was mentioned, we're looking at the Livernois 6 Mile area. And you're exactly right. Most times in around the country, when you see a sizable amount of investment, particularly in the brick and mortar, in the streets, the buildings, the infrastructure. What happens is the values of those properties, the value of those assets increase, and people typically don't keep pace. And so with those rising prices, and they slowly move out. And you know, the classic term gentrification comes from that root word, the gentry, mm-hmm. where nobility comes into an area and invests in it, and then it pushes out or creates economic pressures to push out local residents. And so that generally happens. But what we're seeing in the Livernois 6 Mile area right now is stability, that you're seeing investment, but you're also seeing people who live there staying. You see a steady flow of new residents coming in who are educated, a little bit more educated than mm-hmm. in the past. Incomes are rising, but not rising at a level where it's putting additional economic pressure for people to move out. And so what it suggests is that for now, that the investments are being used and appreciated by the local residents, that it's benefiting the people who are there, encouraging them to stay. So and so that's the overarching top end finding, and it varies from neighborhood to neighborhood in terms of demographics slightly, but overall between Bagley, University District, Palmer Park, Fitzgerald, Merrick Grove, and Martin Park, that you're seeing stability. And that's a good thing.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, in the report, you say that despite the overall fluctuation in population, Livernois 6 Mile has remained 90% African American. And while the investment there has really gone up, median income has increased just a modest 3%. And in the same period, home occupancy rebounded to 77% with a 56% home ownership rate. I mean, it's in some ways, it's the ideal outcome for this kind of investment. And again, it's not the kind of thing that we see all the time in Detroit or in other cities. Talk about, and we're going to talk more deeply about this later, but talk about why you think, Andre, this is different. What's going on in this area that we're not doing other places?
Yeah, people from Livernois 6 Mile don't have to look far to see displacement in other parts of the city.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why it's encouraging. And in fact, we may have seen a lot of people who have been pushed out or discouraged by the displacement in other parts of the city and moving in to the Livernois 6 Mile area because there's history there. There are family members there. But I think, again, I can't say this enough, that when you have investment pouring into a place that benefits people, meaning that the developers who are receiving various investments are living in that area, that the restaurants or the streetscapes are benefiting the people there. That tells me that there's more of a deliberate effort to invest in people. If there's sort of a framework that I use to say how to prevent these things, I say you have to invest in people first. If you invest, and the second prong is invest in place. So if you only invest in brick and mortar, like I said earlier, you'll raise property values and people can't keep pace. So you have to invest in people, meaning invest in homeowners, potential homeowners, entrepreneurs, potential entrepreneurs, developers who are from the area, because they're if they receive these investments, that those profits, that work will bleed into the community and everyone benefits. But if they're not from the community, those investments will not only benefit the people who are there.
Yeah.
So you invest in people. You do need to invest in place. You do need to make targeted infrastructure investments in the streets, the buildings, and the facilities there. But then the third thing I think you have to do is divest from racism. Like this belief that one group has all the answers, and they're typically from the outside. Oftentimes what I find that the answers are right there. The people who can make change happen, they are in the community. And so it's just important to make sure that you invest strategically in the assets, in the strength of these neighborhoods who live there.
Yeah. So, Chase, there's an awful lot of intentionality that I hear in what Andre is describing. You live in the neighborhood and are someone who's really working in this space quite a bit. Where did that intentionality come from in this case? How did we make the decision to do this differently?
So I'm probably going to complicate the tapestry a little bit. So, When I think about what Andre just laid out, right? So investing in people first, investing in place, and divesting from racism. What I really thought was exceptional about this report is that when you look at the numbers of bank investment, right, there's HMDA data, Home Mortgage Disclosure Act data, from 2000 to 2010, there was almost $865 million of just traditional bank investment in these neighborhoods, mm-hmm. right? These are people going to banks, getting mortgages to purchase the home or refinance the home, right? So people were individuals were investing in place, right? And they were able to get the financing to do so. So when we talk to, legacy residents, right? I moved into the neighborhood in 2017. But when you talk to a Stephanie Harbin, who's quoted in the report, right? Or a Lauren Hood, who grew up in the neighborhood, also quoted in the report, you know, they talk about what the neighborhood felt like growing up, mm-hmm. And what it was pre-2000. Right. And part of what I think created that culture was that people could access capital.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Systemic capital. This wasn't, you know, the
conventional
capital by traditional banks. What happened after the recession hit, though, in 2008 and 2009 is that we went from, again, $865 million of investment to far, far less. So, about $64.5 million. So, I mean, that shift.
It's just a fraction.
It's just a fraction. So what I'm seeing when I talk about there's a lot of construction happening in Bagley and other parts of the five neighborhoods, a lot of this is private investor dollars, right? People are using their own equity, their own cash. And, you know, the people that I teach in building community value, Detroit residents who want to, you know, purchase that land bank house across the street or, you know, down the street, they're not able to get traditional financing,
right?
Right.
They're
cut off from it, and they have to sort of be strappy about how do they find the cash to do these projects. So systemically, we are investing in place. There have been policy decisions from the city of Detroit, as well as community development financial institutions. So these are nonprofit financial institutions that are supposed to stand in the gap when traditional banks won't lend. And we have, you know, LISC that has lent. We have Invest Detroit, which has done a lot of lending. When you see CDFIs show up, though, it's that the market isn't functioning the way it traditionally should.
Yeah.
And we saw that shift. So now we're seeing CDFI capital being invested. So we do have new businesses that are opening. You know, I've benefited from the Strategic Neighborhood Fund. I couldn't do the real estate development I do without it.
Yeah.
But that's on 6 Mile, right? We're seeing it on the corridors, on 6 Mile, on 7 Mile. But when you actually get into the neighborhood, the residential, we're not seeing the same dynamic of traditional capital being able to be accessed.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, we need to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Andre Perry and Chase Cantrell about what is going on over on the Livernois and 6 and 7 and 8 Mile corridors in Northwest Detroit. We want to get going with you, the listeners, on the phones and on social. Give us a call. Let us know what you think we ought to be doing to redevelop things in Detroit by including the people who are already here, the majority African-American population that lives in the city of Detroit. How come in so many cases what we see is displacement or gentrification taking place? Why is this area of the city, Livernois and 6 Mile, so different? 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and at WDET, and we can make you part of the conversation that way. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. You're listening to Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm really glad that you're with us. Today, we're talking about how we redevelop areas of Detroit without displacing the people who have lived there for a long time. This is a city that is 80% African American, and some of the things that are happening in the city, some of the new exciting things, are a real threat to that Black presence. People are spending money in places and in ways that are displacing African Americans. Today, though, we're talking about a particular place in Detroit, in Northwest Detroit, around Livernois and 6 Mile, that looks different, where an enormous amount of investment has not seemed to displace Black people nearly as much as in other places. The question is why, and how do we duplicate that in other areas of the city? We've got two great guests here to discuss it. Andre Perry is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He researches race, structural inequality, and education. He's produced a recent report titled Investment Without Displacement, How a Surge of Development Changed and Didn't Change One Detroit Neighborhood, that looks specifically at the area we're talking about. Also with us is Chase Cantrell. He is the founder and executive director of Building Community Value, which is a community-driven redevelopment effort here in the city. He's also a lecturer at the University of Michigan Taubman College of Architecture and Urban Planning. We want to hear from you, our listeners, today. 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. That's 313-577-1019. Call and tell us about your part of Detroit, how it is changing or not, what you think we ought to be doing to change Detroit in a positive way and not be displacing the folks who are here, and what kinds of things you think are working in places like Livernois Six Mile. Maybe you live in another part of the city that you want to talk about similar kinds of change. Again, 313-577-1019 is the number. You can also go to Twitter and at WDET. And we can include you in the conversation that way. Chase, I want to talk a little more about the contrast here. What's happening in Livernois, Six Mile is different from what we're seeing in other places in the city. But talk about some of those other places. And I guess what we're trying to get at here is, what is the difference? Why is it working in this area in such a positive way, and it doesn't seem to be duplicating in other places?
So I have a few thoughts about that, but one is that the median income in this particular area is a bit higher than the rest of the city, and I think the report that Brookings put together points to this, that there's high home ownership in this area. I think we said 56%. If you look at other areas of the city where the rental proportion of renters is higher, the report sort of suggests that, it's that population is more vulnerable when you have to depend on pricing from a landlord, right? So if you're thinking about what we talk about, naturally occurring affordable housing in the city of Detroit, this is market driven, right? It's affordable because the landlord has set a rate that he or she knows the population around that site can afford.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're being able to access housing for $600-$700 bucks a month, that can be affordable for a Detroiter with a median income that's less than $40,000. But in this neighborhood, except for Palmer Park, where there are a lot of renters, you have mostly homeowners over in Bagley University, Fitzgerald, and Martin Park. So I think that's part of the dynamic that's happening. Mm-hmm. And when you look at other areas in the 139 square miles, I think that we have a lot more vulnerable populations who are at risk that rents could rise if things shift. Yeah. So I think that's part of the problem.
Yeah. The home ownership question in Detroit is critical to the redevelopment of the city and the building of wealth. It's also kind of a moving target right now. I mean, we've been for many decades a place that had an overwhelming percentage of single-family owned properties.
Right.
We went from that to being a majority city of renters for a short period of time, and now we're kind of back to a majority home ownership stake, but it doesn't look quite the same as it did before. I mean, it's one of the things we really got to rebuild.
And the way that I want people to think about this is, though, we hover around that 50-50, right? We keep going back and forth, but it's not as though it's a huge shift in either direction. So we really do have to think about
how to
move home ownership up, but also how to protect renters, because we're always going to have a rental population in the city. Councilmember Mary Waters actually suggested a tenants' rights commission that's moving through council right now. So how do we ensure that, one, we're protecting tenants, mm-hmm. that we're making sure that we understand the dynamics of rental rates in the city, but also making sure that we're thinking about affordability when we are building new things. So part of my challenge in talking to system actors, and part of my concern about what might happen in the five neighborhoods we're talking about in the future, is that we're hoping that, or the system is hoping that we're creating a market.
Yeah.
Like the goal is that you create these new things, it will have spillover effects, new businesses will open, more people will buy homes, but we're hoping the market takes over. Well, what happens when the market takes over is that rental rates rise.
Yeah.
And if we're not being very targeted from municipal policy in creating actual regulated affordable housing in these areas, we're going to have issues in 5 or 10 years.
Yeah, yeah. Andre Perry, I wonder if you can put this in a little bit of national context for us, what we're doing here on the Live 6 area and contrast it to what we see in other cities. What should Detroit be looking at, I guess, in other places to be more intentional in the way you were describing earlier about protecting populations who are already in an area and then welcoming investment that lifts their lives as well?
Yeah, and I will widen the aperture just a bit and state that whenever a neighborhood experiences an economic shock it can't handle, that's when you see the kinds of displacement mm-hmm. we're seeing in other parts. So everyone wants investment, but if the investment comes too rapidly or it's too large of an amount, it creates a radical or dramatic change in which the residents can't handle, they're going to move out. And so across the country and even within Detroit, you've seen in certain parts of downtown where there's this a large investment, sizable investment over a short period of time. And as was stated, the renters there can't handle the increase in prices, not only in housing, but in overall cost of living. And they move out. But in places, I think, where there's an investment and the residents can handle it, you see more stability and more take up. And I can't say this enough, that ultimately investments, particularly from philanthropy, can help. But it's really the investments from everyday economic activity, home loans, business loans, things like that, spending. That's what really raises a neighborhood or a region of a city. And so, yes, we want to see investment. Communities want to see investment, but they want to see investments in a way that they can take it up. They can utilize it themselves and see the growth. And just one other point to this.
Sure.
That I think that when it comes to areas that have a higher level of renters, for instance, that requires a different kind of investment. So it's not that the Livernois 6 Mile had the right combination of home ownership. It's that it was the right kind of match between the investments and the capacity.
Yeah.
So for me, yeah, we need to see investments in other parts of the city that may have a higher percentage of renters, but we should see investment that converts renters to homeowners, that allows renters to have the amenities and to have the services, the parks, the recreation that other places can have that won't increase their rents. So for me, it's about the match.
Yeah.
And it's, again, being deliberate about the kind of investment in a way that doesn't shock the community.
Yeah, yeah. So Chase Cantrell, You got a message while we were sitting here talking from Maggie DeSantis, who was used to be the founder. Well, she was the founder and the president of the Warren Connor Development Corporation over on the East Side. That's now East Side Community Network.
That's right.
She had a really good question for you about how you apply what we're seeing here in other parts of the city that are really different and face really different questions.
Right.
Go ahead and repeat what she said. If I didn't get it,
no, you got it exactly right. And I think what Andre just said actually is responsive to that, right? So if you're in a neighborhood where there is not a match between the investment and the capacity of the residents to sort of absorb that investment, that's when you begin to see real displacement.
Yeah.
Right. You do see rental rates rise. You do see the cost of living going up. So what I love about this report is that, I mean, usually when, you know, an institution like Brookings or, you know, an academic institution like the University of Michigan does a longitudinal study, it's a look back, right? We're looking back 20 years to see what happened. But what Andre does is he gives a roadmap for, and Eastside Community Network could do this, you know, or any, you know, Live Six Alliance could continue this kind of study in on an ongoing basis, continuing to look at the HMDA data, the population, the eviction rates, those kinds of things, to know in closer proximity in time what's happening.
Yeah.
If that kind of negative change actually is happening, and if we need to shift policy. Our problem is we wait until 10 years out to look back and say, oh, you know, displacement has already happened.
We should have done these things, right?
Right. Instead, I think that this allows either municipal government or partnerships between government and academic institutions to do this kind of work in real time. And I think that, you know, Brookings adds to the kind of research that's happening nationally of what kinds of things you have to look at.
Yeah. Go ahead, Andre.
Let me add to that. Yeah. Yes, that is exactly right. What I want to do with our research at Brookings and other cities is to encourage this type of work at a local level. It's the Detroit Future Cities of the world. Mm-hmm. It's the Wayne States of the world. It's the local institutions that ultimately have to have these kind of scorecards, if you will, that drives investment, and they should always have local representation in the analyses. These kind of reports almost inevitably have to come with local perspectives, and we take our time and due diligence to make sure we're hearing from people on what's happening. But again, ultimately, it's the local organizations that must take on these templates, if you will, so that future investment, and they're ongoing. Let's be clear, like the strategic neighborhood funds are ongoing, and we can continue to do these kinds of analyses, and not just to sort of punish or to say, look what you didn't do, but more so, what can you do to improve the quality of life of residents in all parts of the city?
Wow. Yeah. Okay, we're going to take another short break. And when we come back, we are going to continue talking with Andre Perry and Chase Cantrell about redevelopment here in Detroit and doing it in a way that protects and lifts up the people who live here. We are going to get to you on the phones and on social as well. If you want to join us, give us a call. 313-577-1019 is the number. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and at WDET, and we can include you in the show that way. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. This is Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm glad you're with us. We're talking today about redevelopment in the city of Detroit and how to do it in a way that includes and lifts up the people who already live here. Of course, the vast majority of those people are African Americans. And in so many cases, not just in Detroit, but in other cities, what we see is that investment changes the demographic in certain neighborhoods or in entire cities. We're talking about the redevelopment specifically around Livernois and 6 Mile here in Detroit, in Northwest Detroit, and how that has looked really different, how that has been more inclusive, and why those things are true. How we kind of lift that up and plop it down in other parts of the city. I want to hear from you on the phones, the listeners. 313-577-1019 is the number, and you can go to Twitter and at WDET to be part of the conversation. We've got two great guests as well. Andre Perry is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution who researches race, structural inequality, and education. He has a new report out called Investment Without Displacement, How a Surge of Development Changed and Didn't Change One Detroit Neighborhood, that came out in January of this year. Also with us is Chase Cantrell. He is the founder and executive director of Building Community Value, which is a community-driven redevelopment project here in the city. He's also a lecturer at the University of Michigan Taubman College of Architecture and urban planning. I want to get first to the phones here. Let's start with Mark in Detroit. Mark, what's on your mind?
Yes, hi, Stephen. Hi. Great topic really a different way to look at things as far as I'm concerned. I live in Corktown. I've been in Corktown since the early 80s, and we all know what's been happening here. And I also lived in my U of D days in the 70s, I lived six. So I'm experiencing both neighborhoods, both on campus and off campus I've lived. So very familiar with both neighborhoods. And the thing here is, and it's a really great way to look at and development as far as at Live 6 and up 7 Mile Avenue Fashion. Right, the demographic is stable. I think one of the things there is that there are a lot of single family homes where in Corktown, there were single family homes, but before development started, there were probably about 260 single family homes that we have, or duplexes. I think that makes a difference. I think like here in Corktown, we have, 3-4 generation families that live here. Mm-hmm. And I think the thing that we need to think about development-wise in neighborhoods is, are we creating neighborhoods or recreating neighborhoods that our kids are going to want to live in? Mm. And obviously that's dependent on employment opportunities for them.
Yeah.
And housing affordability. Because without single family homes, without single families, neighborhoods become very, very sterile.
Yeah. That idea of passing on a neighborhood or even an individual home to the next generation is a big part of stability and making sure that demographics don't change, whether there's new investment in a neighborhood or not. We also don't do well with that in Detroit, Chase. And in fact, Detroit Future City just had a report out about that gap between Detroit and other places when you think about people passing property on to their kids. That is one of the things that stabilizes gentrification.
No, that's right. And the DFC report is a good one. I know that City Council has also been interested in this. Mm-hmm. Councilmember Scott Benson has been specifically interested in this. But how do we ensure that, when an elder passes away in our community and leaves that house to family members, that someone might move in, but they don't know the legal process necessary to go through probate and actually get that house in the new person's name. There are thousands and thousands of homes like that in the city of Detroit where people are occupying them and, haven't gone through the legal process and may eventually lose it to foreclosure.
Mm-hmm.
So it really is, coming up with systemic solutions, and DFC suggests some, to be able to say, all right, well, we will make sure that there are supports for that eventuality so that people do remain in those homes and have stability and have actual legal title to those homes. So I think, it's not just about single family homes, though, that single family or duplexes. It still is about the home ownership because, over 65% of our housing stock is single family in the city of Detroit. It's very unique in terms of, that sort of framework. Kansas City is the only other city that's kind of close to us. Most other cities have lots more multifamily. So when you come to Detroit, what you might not realize is that a lot of our rental units actually are single family homes. right? And people are used to renting single family homes in the city. So it's not just that housing stock.
Because that's most of what we have.
It's most of what we have. Yeah. So it's not just that housing stock, but it's also home ownership of that housing.
Yeah, yeah. I really appreciate the call and the comments. Let's next go to Dan in Southfield. Dan, welcome to the show.
Oh, hey, Stephen. Always a pleasure to listen to your civil conversation. I am born and raised in the St. Mary's area, Grand River and Greenfield kind of area.
Yeah.
And you know, we have definitely experienced this big problem with the lack. We used to have almost 100% home ownership in our area. Grandmont, those kind of areas, mm-hmm. North Rosedale.
Mm-hmm.
We have experienced a huge amount of rentals, which, not to say anything negative about people who are renting a house, but they have less stake in it, okay? And people who are renting them the property have less stake in it. People that own their own homes, Detroit used to have the highest rate of black home ownership in the country.
Yeah, it did.
I mean, what the hell happened?
I mean, you know, there are a lot of explanations for that could take us days really to talk about here on the radio. But I mean, the same things that created the other problems that we have in Detroit, deindustrialization, you know, offshoring of jobs and capital, racism, all of those things, you know, together created this situation that we find ourselves in right now. I mean, you know, Dan, I appreciate the call. I think the question is how we get back to what we were doing before and what we were capable of before, and that is also a really complicated story. Go ahead,
yeah,
Chase.
Yeah, and Dan, I really appreciate the question because I grew up in that area, so right off of Greenfield, really Greenfield and Puritan, and you know I still have family in that area, so I'm familiar with the dynamics. And what you know, I alluded to this earlier, and the report talks about this. You know, there used to be greater access to mortgage financing, right? And a lot of these homes, especially when you get further north of Grandmont, you know, a lot of banks won't actually lend for small dollar mortgages.
Absolutely.
You know, there have been, we've had that conversation before in WDET with Detroit Future City, mm-hmm. came on and talked about that. So, you know, if a renter wants to become a homeowner or wants to access a home in, you know, St. Mary's Quarry, that neighborhood, it's difficult to find the financing. We actually have lots of Detroiters who go through home ownership programs to learn about how to become a homeowner. We actually have like a glut of these sorts of programs in Detroit. I think we have 16 organizations that do that throughout the city. That's huge compared to most other cities. So hundreds of Detroiters are going through these programs every year, but on the other end, they're not able to access the financing. So I think that's why we see renters in communities like that. It's not that they don't want to become homeowners. It's just that the system isn't situated such to actually allow that to happen.
It's a lot harder.
Yes.
To become a homeowner for the first time now than I can ever remember it being. I mean, there was a much lower burden.
And before. I'll even say, like, purchasing a home in Bagley was not necessarily a simple process either.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. You know, in a stable neighborhood.
In a stable neighborhood. I purchased the house in 2021, and that was a process.
Yeah. Yeah. Andre, I heard you go ahead.
You know, and I'll maybe even address some of the comments of the last caller with my response. One, in conversations about housing, we always tend to neglect to talk about income and what's in people's pocket, mm-hmm. the ability to purchase a home. And so in throughout the, you know, the city, we have not seen incomes rise in ways that would suggest you can create more homeowners. And if that is the issue, then as Chase is stating, we need new mortgage products, new types of assistance programs,
mm-hmm.
New ownership models. But what I think is happening, we have said, hey, look at the demand. Let's create all these rental units around the city. when in fact we should be saying, hey, look at the demand. Let's create new ownership opportunities for residents of the city. And that's a very different thing. And that means that it's incumbent upon employers to make sure that they're paying people at a wage that they can purchase a home. That means municipal governments are paying public employees enough where they can live downtown or other parts of the city. And in addition, we need lenders to expand their what is known as special purpose credit programs, providing mortgages in cases that don't require a down payment, because we often see people who've been discriminated against over time, young people. They're doing everything right, but they just don't have the down payment to get into a home. So I want us to just always remember that in this sort of supply demand sort of argument and the diversity of the housing in the city, because we do need rental properties, we do need single family homes, but we do need multifamily units, we need innovation in the space to convert people who are renting to become owners, and that should be the goal in within any kind of diversity of housing in a city.
We've only got a couple minutes left, but I do want to talk a little about gentrification and the different kinds of gentrification that we see, and how we know and how we define those things. Chase, cultural gentrification is something we talk about sometimes.
That's right.
It looks different from actual displacement.
This is why I tend not to use the word gentrification, is because everyone is approaching it with a different
definition. Everyone has a different idea.
Right. And I have a colleague, Bucky Willis, who talks about systemic, cultural, emotional, and physical.
Wow.
Right. And I think that sort of encapsulates the conversations that we have.
Yeah.
You have Black Detroiters who go downtown and sometimes feel a cultural mismatch with the things that are happening there.
It doesn't feel the way it used to.
It does not feel the way it used to. So is that gentrification, right? If that person never lived there and wasn't displaced physically from a home, I think some people still say it would. So what I think is wonderful, so I don't always give credit where it's due, but the Strategic Neighborhood Fund, so again, Invest Detroit and the City of Detroit, what they've done really well is that when they're looking at how they make corridor investments, you know, what developers they're bringing in and what businesses, they're looking to Black and brown developers and business owners. They're very intentional about how we're curating that culture of people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we feel it in Live 6. Right. When I look around the businesses that are there, it feels like it represents the culture. And I think that the people who are living in those neighborhoods are responding to that. And I see that in other neighborhoods as well. I mean, on the Far East Side, I think ECN is doing a great job. Grandma Rosedale is doing a great job. Yeah. So I think it's important that we have to lean into to who's creating the business and service culture in our neighborhoods.
Yeah. Yeah. Andre Perry, I want to get your thoughts on that. We've got about a minute, though.
Yeah, I think about gentrification. It's mostly of the economic pressures that push people out. But I would be lying if I didn't say that oftentimes there is a deliberate effort to sanitize culture from a place.
And,
and that's such a mistake, because culture is an asset. It's a reason why people move to certain neighborhoods.
Sure.
So you want to accentuate culture in a way that enhances the quality of life of a neighborhood.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, Andre Perry of the Brookings Institution and Chase Cantrell of Building Community Value. Really, really great to have the two of you here for this conversation. Thanks so much for joining us on Created Equal.
It's always a pleasure, Stephen.
Yeah.
Bring me back.
Yes, you'll be back for sure. All right, Kerry Jr., that's going to do it for us on Created Equal today.
That was a very good conversation, Stephen.
It was really interesting. They were great. And we really got to that question that I was really eager about, which is how we kind of lift this up and apply it in other places. How do we think about it on the East Side or in Southwest?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The note about Andre Perry saying that the areas that can manage the investment are the ones that succeed. And that was really powerful for me. So
absolutely.
Really great conversation. Great takeaways. Thank you to Chase. Thank you to Andre.
Yeah. Okay, that's going to do it for us on Created Equal today. Come back tomorrow for more great content. You can listen to recent episodes of Created Equal online at WDET.org. And of course, we would love for you to subscribe to our podcast. Created Equal is produced by Kerry Jr. II and David Lines. Our sound editing is by Connor Anderson. The music is by Sam Bobian. And our digital team is Jenny Sherman, Dave Kim, and Sophia Joswiak. Our program director is Adam Fox. This is 101.9 WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.